and welcome to How To Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. My name is Ari.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're going to be talking about records and interpreting historical paperwork, specifically inventory. So we've talked a lot in the past about developing impressions, and we say things like, you know, closer to the source is better, and try and triangulate, use multiple lines of evidence. And one of the things we've referenced in the past are receipts and inventories. However, one of those places where historians and living history enthusiasts, for lack of a better word, tend to digress is that there is a very specific way to interpret historical data that professional historians get training in how to do, but we don't necessarily have that same resource. And so sometimes there's information out there that will be beneficial to a impression that we just don't know how to read. And that's not really an admission of failure or anything like that. It's just we don't have those resources. And so today's episode is an attempt at maybe getting a little more insight into how to interpret some of these more technical documents, understanding that we are also not professional historians or researchers of documents. But there are things that we can keep in mind that might help you in your pursuits.
Yeah, so looking at these documents, first of all, a lot of you probably out there can be like, well, where do we even find these documents? A lot of places have digitized these documents for you to look through. Some of the quality can be a little suspect, but a lot of times, if you don't have access to be able to travel to England to one of the libraries over there, one of the college libraries, you might not be able to find a lot of them. So what we're going to be using today to sort of go through this is actually a thesis paper written by Roland Thomas Richardson on the medieval inventories of the Tower Armories, 1320 to 1410. So this is a compilation, looking at a compilation of almost 100 years of different inventories. So you got to take, when looking at like this is a secondary source of these. We're not looking at the primary source of the inventories, but you can still glean a lot of information from that because it's actually really nice because it's broken down for you into a bunch of different sections for you to look at. The armor and the armor is broken down to different sections, and the weapons are broken down to different sections and things like that. So, but when looking at something like this, you got to remember that this is 100 years. So some things that are in there would be perfectly fine for 1410. They're not going to be perfectly fine for 1320. Just remember that when you start looking at these long sort of compendiums of the wardrobe or armament details.
And what's handy about this one, which we're using as an example today, but obviously is not the sole resource, is that this thesis comes with a little bit of context that you may or may not have developed with if you just managed to get a photocopy of the receipt. You photocopy documents like that, but if you had some direct reproduction of it that you were to study on your own, you know, that would be far more of a challenge. What something like this does, even if it doesn't apply to your time period, does help guide you on how to interpret other documents if those are the ones that are more important to your impression. But because this is a very popular time period and a very popular subject from an incredibly popular part of the world that is reenacted, this will be our best sort of showcase, because it also comes, this is a document that you can go and read along with us or after the episode and have a leg up when you actually are trying to do some interpretation.
And what's great about looking at something like this, like a thesis paper, is the source material is clearly outlined in it where they got all this from. So you can backtrack to the primary source material if you really want to, if you can search and find them. But I like looking through thesis papers. I know it sounds nerd alert, thesis paper. Some of them can be very dry just because of the style of the writing on it. You know, these aren't written for your casual readers. These are written for academia. So they want to be all professional and academic sounding.
Yeah, of course. And to kind of digress a little bit more about theses in particular, since this is a perfect opportunity to talk about them, is, yeah, I've said in the past that sometimes secondary sources can be more valuable than first, like primary sources. And this is an example of a situation where I will never derive as much benefit from just having a pile of old 500-year-old receipts sitting on my desk as I will being able to look at the interpretation of someone who has spent their entire doctoral study towards understanding a topic. Because I don't have the 5 years that they spent working on their thesis plus all the time they had in undergraduate school to have the same level of proficiency that they do. And while it's important to make sure that we are aware of the potential biases or inaccuracies that come with relying on somebody else's authority on a subject, this kind of resource I will always gravitate towards before I try and make entirely novice interpretations of an archival document.
And yeah, exactly. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I think the author actually put it in their own words when writing the paper, talking about how he said the inventories include a wealth of information about arms and armor in England in the 14th century, only very small parts of which have been published, and they record the evolution of the armory at the Tower, meaning the Tower of London, from a relatively minor armory to the national arsenal as it became in the 16th to 19th centuries. So this is taking a cross-section of time when we all think of the Tower of London being, you know, being the place in London for, you know, prisoners and armaments and things like that, where for a while it wasn't that. It was just sort of the regional place, because it was hard to get, you know, ship something from London all the way out up to the top of the border there and back again. Looking at these and following the patterns of them, if you read the paper, it shows, like he says in the paper, how there was a change in the way that they were handling getting their troops armed, and how, you know, we all like to think, oh, it was medieval times, everybody just walked around with swords and spears and axes all the time. Well, no, not really. As we looking at these documents, it shows that this was a central place where basically there was a conflict. People came to the tower, got equipped, went to the conflict as a group, came back to the tower, and left their arms there. So no, people weren't just walking around with this stuff all the time, or they didn't have to have it within their own possession, like at their house or something, all the time. There were these places where they were basically stockpiled and left to be used for whatever conflict came up next.
Absolutely. And that gives you a sense of, like you were saying, what is, we have a lot of conflicting mentalities sometimes on what people were readily accessible to them. So what you pointed out here is an interesting contrast between things like this unspoken idea that every able-bodied man had a sword hanging above the threshold of their cottage hovel. Just because, say, an assize of arms requires a man to have a sword doesn't necessarily mean that it's sitting on top of their grain arc at all times, sitting, bouncing around and in the way. Societies, being much more communal in the Middle Ages, had methods of being able to fulfill these obligations without either the expense of the logistics of every single person toting around an entire war harness when 90% of their life they're plowing fields. And so this is a great example of a way that perhaps some people fulfilled their obligations towards needing to be able to be ready to be called, but don't necessarily have to be a like quick release force or a quick response force where they can be armed in 20 minutes and responding to the, you know, Mongol hordes kind of thing. And so there was a lot of ways in which people didn't necessarily have to go about their day burdened by things in spaces where they didn't necessarily have the same amount of space that we would consider, you know, your modern American home to have.
Well, I would say it also shows sort of the change of the military system of the time, that evolution of the array where people showed up with all their stuff and they had to have a certain amount of things in their possession, depending on their wealth, and, you know, be ready to fight from there, to this more central military, while not like what we would call the military today. You know, that didn't really start coming about until the 17th century, but it's still more of a centralized military where people were storing their stuff all in the same place and things like that. I'm sure some people still took some stuff home with them because, you know, it was theirs, but there was always a sort of stockpile for people who couldn't have their own things to be able to be armed.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to think as we carry on with this thought experiment, how that may have been not necessarily attributing all of it to this one particular concept, but it does make it a lot easier to even come up with the idea of what we would consider a, you know, more Burgundian style standing army when you have established repositories for large amounts of equipment that can be issued instead of personally owned, like leasing out a sword to somebody who you've contracted versus every single person showing up out of the woods with their own weaponry. You know, how can you reasonably conceive of a ordered top-down standing military in an environment where there isn't even a place that you could centralize that kind of equipment logistics? So in some ways, perhaps not with the intent of getting to the standing army solution, perhaps trying to solve other contemporary problems, these kinds of growing armories were fertile ground for new ideas. So it's kind of interesting to think about how that might have contributed to the progression of the formation of militaries without having any intention of doing so.
What you're going to find going right into these is there's going to be terms for things that, one, there may be multiple terms used for the same item. There might be different terms used for there might be multiple terms used for the same item. There might be the same term used for multiple item. And there might be things that you've never even heard of in your life. It's like, I'm looking at the list right now, once you get into the armor section, and it lists something called one pair of Musekins. That's Musekins. Musekins. I have no idea what a Musekin is. And a lot of people actually, I think in the paper, he even states, we don't know what these are. We're not 100% sure what they are, but there's a lot of conjecture out there of what they might be. Probably we think that they were male of some form. But we just don't know what. So that's going to take a little more digging. Sometimes when you look at these lists, they take a little more digging than just reading the list to totally figure out what they're talking about.
Absolutely. You can't. And that's one of those things that we, you know, finally reaching back to the thesis of this article. What are some things to remember when interpreting inventory data? Is that inventory data is entirely sterile of context outside of what people already thought they knew what meant. And so I kind of make this comparison between, you know, you get yourself a Walmart receipt, and the way that they have abbreviated a number of items is not meant to be interpretable even necessarily by you. You know, sometimes the abbreviations they use are completely nonsensical, but it means something to corporate Walmart. And it certainly isn't intended to be understood by somebody 100 years from now speaking a different language. And so a lot of items are going to be there, and it's not the end-all be-all of what you can then put into your kit. So one of the great examples of that I have is that, you know, you'll see it lists, you know, 30 some odd pairs of helms, or like what kind of helm? Are they bassinet? Are they kettle hats? Are they, well, I guess it actually specifies kettle hats versus helms, but you know, we know from the evolution of armor that the word helm, just like the word sword, doesn't refer to one specific object in one specific timeline that is different than all the other things that people just called helms. It's like, I call my vehicle a car, but what I call a car today may not be the same, and most definitely will not be the same model or brand as I called my car, to sort of just calling it colloquially a car 10 years ago. They were different vehicles, but that doesn't help you identify what kind of vehicle I had, but it does help you understand that I had a car. So when you, that's the limitation of these bits of information. So you have helms, but like you said, you have to dig to find out what kind of helm. And that's assuming that they even differentiated between things. So say you have a bunch of different gauntlets. Were they at the time articulating the difference between hourglass gauntlets and what we would call clamshell style gauntlets? Or were those just all like gauntlets? Because in the time period, who, you know, they all understood what it was they were using. So who cares? Like, we make these, we parse these things down sometimes far deeper than they necessarily needed to in the day-to-day operations, because they were just trying to get business done.
It's like, I was looking at a different account a couple years ago. I'm looking it back up to see exactly what it is I was talking about. But I came across the term gusarm, right? Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but actually, no, I'm sorry. It was this account. I was looking to it 3 years ago now. So we come across this in the term gusarm, right? And they specifically, within this paper, have a delineation for gusarms called hasgays. So this is sort of, you know, we all know in sort of the D&D nomenclature of what a gusarm is. A gusarm is a very specific weapon. It's the has the long point with the sort of the hooked blade, if I'm recalling what D&D sort of, yeah, that has that sort of long hook, curved blade with a separate spike or hook on the end of it. It's a pole weapon.
In 3.5, if not and not 5th edition, I'm not quite certain, but definitely in Pathfinder, it was a classified trip weapon. That's important. That's why it's so popular. Because if you fail your trip attempt, you can just drop your weapon instead of getting tripped yourself.
Oh, there you go. But so, and I think this actually, looking at Wikipedia, I know we shouldn't trust Wikipedia as far as you can throw it sometimes, but this is actually a pretty good one. You know, it says it was a pole arm used between the year 1000 and 1400. Well, that's a 400 year statement. Time span. Yeah. So it's like, you know, to think that the one back in, you know, the year 1000, sorry, 1000, whatever you want to call it, yeah, 1000, 1000 looked the same as 1400. No, they probably changed. And they said it was, you know, of course, it was designed by peasants because it was a farming tool and things like that. Well, in this paper we look at, it actually has a listing of them calling, it's like there's a list of 5 gusarms known as or called hasgays. So which this leads me to believe, and I've talked to some other people more knowledgeable about it than I am, that perhaps even the term gusarm itself may have been a broader weapon type than what we believe it to be. And
is that like hoping that the word pole arm refers to a specific weapon?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because I'm looking at these things, it's like, I don't see anywhere where they list like pole arms. Yeah, there's pole axes, but those are somewhat of a specific weapon. But they tend to use it, especially in these inventories, they use, like Ari was saying, they use these broader terms than what we want them to. We want them to be super specific and tell us exactly what they had. It's sort of like looking at, I don't know, like a food storage place. It's like they're writing down, we have 500 potatoes. They're not saying they have 500 russet potatoes or 500 Yukon gold potatoes. They're just saying they have 500 potatoes because they don't care how many they have. They all know, all they know is that they're potatoes. And it doesn't matter what different types they are. They just know that they have 500 of them. That's all that matters. So looking at a lot of these inventories, it's sort of the same way. They'll throw things in there saying, like Ari said, we have 100 helmets. It's like, well, what kind of helmets?
Yeah. And I find that to be an interesting thought because not that necessarily you can use modern language to perfectly interpret historical language, but we all know that arm, A-R-M-E, is derived from French for like a weapon. That's why we call it being armed or having arms, is that that's a derivative of the word arm in French. And if I recall correctly, d'aiguille is like mistletoe. So if we're talking about a French version of the bill, like the English bill, which was an arboreal tool turned weapon, and this was something for cutting down things out of trees, and so they just called it a geese arm, a mistletoe weapon, like the same thing where you've got I'm blanking on the word right now. The big cleaver on a stick that they used as a pole arm too. Vardige. So like all these agricultural tools that perhaps, you know, that might be a great way to just say like, hey, you know, everyone knows what a bill looks like. And so when we call it a bill arm, like a bill weapon, people understand we're talking about the militarized version of your arboreal tool. And perhaps this is the same thing. Not that I've studied it at all. I just happen to have practiced enough Duolingo to know that to have that one word seem to make some sense to me. And that might be where you get these general catch-all terms too. And that makes a lot of sense because we do use catch-all terms a ton when we're trying to deal with large volumes of things where the individual status of each one isn't important for the documentation that's being provided for it. Especially since these receipts weren't designed for us to study arms and armor later. It was to make sure people got paid and didn't lose stuff. And then, you know, just like a receipt now, you do your taxes, you throw them away. Like, no one cares at some point what these mean later on.
Yeah, it's an inventory system and a cost system, you know, because most of these are also listed as like, you know, in here, it's 12 small lance staves at 60 shillings, you know, so it's like they're saying how much of these they have and how much it costs for them to have them.
Absolutely. And another interesting thing we were talking about with language, I remember the first time I went through this document, they were talking about in it, they were talking about helmets covered in leather. And I know that leather covered things are very, it's a much talked about subject in living history, you know, covering your helmets, covering your breastplates. Is a covered breastplate the same as a corazine? Is it, how is that different than, you know, the brigandines, and do they have fabric? Do they have leather? Do they have this, they have that? And what I found more interesting when I read about helmets, or specifically bassinets covered in white leather, which you can find in the document here in one of the inventories from the early 1300s, is that when you look at the footnotes, it describes them as bassinetes, and I'm going to butcher the Latin because that's not what I'm studying, bassinetes di albo coreo cupertis. And if you were to plug all of that into Google Translate under Latin, you would find that it says, you know, covered in white leather, but bassinetis, I don't know how to pronounce the last S in Latin, but having that word doesn't translate in your typical language translators, because that's a word that never progressed long enough to become part of like popular modern Latin. because bassinet isn't really a word that we use outside of historical context. Like, at some point, the word bassinet died out, and we, this community, knows about it because we've studied ancient armor. But now a bassinet is a thing you put a baby in, right? And so there's no real Latin, like, it hasn't been passed down. The Latin hasn't necessarily survived enough for it to become part of the popular corpus of Latin vocabulary. And so I find it very interesting that if I, say, were to have just a blank list of that particular inventory from, what is it here? The inventory of 1324 at the tower. If I had only that, and I had this word, this line item, and I were to try and translate it, maybe I would understand that it means bassinets, but that would be an assumption based on no real good evidence, because I just don't have that kind of research. So that's sort of another point towards the benefit of having this thesis, because they're able to translate it with a certain level of authority that I couldn't match myself.
And a lot of this, if you're looking through these without the thesis to go with it and that sort of translation, it's sometimes you got to use, you know, you got to sort of infer some information here, especially when you get to like the later end of it. We know that the bassinet was the predominantly popular helmet style in England after a certain, you know, between a certain point. So a lot of times, you know, when they say, you know, they have 121 helmets, you can reasonably assume that the majority of those are going to be the bassinet. And yeah, there could be some kettle helms or things mixed in with there, or other things as well. But for the most part, you can assume that the majority of those are going to be of a certain style. But that's taking in prior knowledge of the time period and the armor of the time period, and using it to come to those conclusions. If you don't have that prior knowledge, you got to bring in other sources. You know, sometimes either see if you can find a listing that has more detail, comparing it with artwork. It's if you can find, you know, artwork that's fairly detailed, and they're picturing everybody in it wearing kettle hats, and say you can put together a lot of artwork that shows everybody wearing kettle hats, and you have an argument that's like, well, maybe the kettle hat was more popular than bassinet, so maybe those helmets, maybe that list of helmets really meant there, you know, it could be more kettle hats. But we know from looking at artwork that the bassinet is depicted more. So that's how you know, for the most part, when you're reading these inventories, if it just says helmet, probably that's what it means, unless it says otherwise.
Right. But that is information that we've had to develop through extra research. We couldn't do that, I think, as you mentioned, we couldn't do that in a vacuum with just the receipt and going, oh, well, it says helmet. Like, without knowing more about the time period, where the inventory came from, what region it came from, things like that, without a lot of extra research, it doesn't really do us any good. It's much more of a supporting document than it is necessarily something that gives us clear information on what we should put into a harness. And one of the points I think that this makes really clear when we make harnesses is it helps contrast artwork, which we have sometimes problems with looking at artwork. You know, what we see depicted in, say, a mass battle where everyone's drawn a specific way isn't always meant to be drawn as a photograph that accurately represents the exact nature of the army. And what I mean by that is, if you look at one of these purchase requests, you see multiple times throughout these different inventories that people are buying pairs of plates and bassinets and helms and cuisses and sabatons. So we realize that people are clearly the kappa piece style. They've got gauntlets, they've got leg defense, they've got torso defense. But if you were to pull out some of these records, you see, for instance, in the record of English plate armor imported from Germany and the Low Countries, this one is from the makers in Cologne, Goetzdahl, John Bertrand, and Gerard. They they gave pairs of plates, right? They also obviously bought tons of cuisses, but they also bought specifically different from cuisses lower leg defenses, which makes, you know, gives an indication that perhaps, you know, getting from hip to toe all as one piece wasn't standard. And you look at 197 pairs of cuisses compared to 73 pairs of lowered leg defense, means that perhaps more people, there you can make multiple conclusions from this. Either there were more people who were wearing armor on the top of their legs than the bottom of their legs, and through anecdotal experience, it's harder to fit something to your shins than it is necessarily to your thigh. It could also mean that we have a higher expectation of wear and tear on upper leg defense. You know, you probably get hit there more often, bust straps, need it to be repaired, taken out of service, so you have spares lying around. But when you take these things in their greater context, you see why, you know, you have to ask questions. Why would you buy nearly twice as many cuisses as you would buy lower leg defenses? It gives you a lot of really good inferences to make, not necessarily assumptions, but deductions on how prevalent is what I'm wearing as a representative of the whole. And we've talked about this in previous episodes about, you know, too many people reenacting the minority. You know, if in art everyone was drawn exactly the same because it's easier on the artist to doodle the same thing 100 times for the unwashed masses of the army in the background, does that accurately reflect how often people were dressed completely head to foot, or in this case, hip to ankle? Or were there more opportunities for someone to go around in just cuisses without shin or greaves, be it shin balls or greaves, completely cased greaves? How prevalent are those things? And if we are we setting the correct standard for expecting every single one of our armed reenactors to have that complete leg harness or not? And does this, the timeline of these inventories, give us better perceptions on what we should expect for our own standards? Not necessarily giving you the answer, because I don't know when you reenact or what your standards are, but these are things we can pull out of inventories that we don't necessarily get from other sources, which is why they're nice to add in. And I wanted to highlight some of their meta benefits, because we're just, especially since we're just talking about how there's many shortfalls to using them as well. I don't want people to give up on them because they're harder to interpret and don't always necessarily sound like they're the best bang for your buck when it comes to time and research, but they can provide a lot too.
You know, Ari is 100% correct on that. When you're reading through these, you can look at, well, there's a couple different ways you can look at it. You know, like you said, one, were they just buying the things that they thought were important? That's why they bought more of one thing than the other. Did they have to buy more of one thing because those things wore out faster? Or were they just easier to come by? There's a lot of that information, those background questions that you might have to do a little more digging when you're looking at these to figure out what's actually going on and what they're actually talking about.
But it's important to know that there's something to research, because if we don't have any indication that we should delve a little deeper, we could be overseeing a nuance that we're ignorant of. And there's not necessarily any shame in not knowing that you should dig deeper, but this is a great way to find evidence of future research projects, because there's clearly something going on that we would like to suss out as either a personal researcher for my own impression, or as the community as a whole for what we're expecting from other people around us.
What I find interesting looking at, especially this one, the Tower Armory one, is that they didn't differentiate. I'm sorry, they did differentiate, but didn't separate storage of things used for battle and things used for the joust. So while there are different categories listed of, like, you know, lances for the joust, cornels for the joust, and lances of war and things like that, they do have them listed separately. They still kept them all in the same place. So they're keeping these almost as like training weapons. Well, they were training weapons, but keeping them as like training weapons within the same collection, just differentiated ones for the joust or tournament. There's a listing in here saying that there was Some list had like 106 swords, one for the tournament, and one was badly damaged. So it was just interesting that they kept them all together.
I mean, it makes sense to keep light objects in the same location, because they didn't have necessarily the OSHA staring down their, or breathing down their necks, being like, yeah, hey, you can't store sharps and blunts in the same container. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it didn't matter as much because maybe because they were more discerning, or because they were more accepting of casualty. There's a lot of that one's up for interpretation, but there is a lot of just keeping like things together. And perhaps a lot of that came down to just the storage facilities. Like, say, I'm not positive what kind of materials they used to store it, but say there's a specific type of rack or a specific type of like oiled canvas that's really good for storing one particular type of item, it becomes much more efficient to take all like kinds of that item and store them in that manner.
It would have been horrible though to rush in there to get something because you're under attack and come out there and you've got the blunt tournament sword.
Yeah, I know, right? That would be no. What you'd have is just a very expensive quarterstaff.
Yeah. Talk about other details you can glean from looking at the inventories. You know, right now I'm looking at the longbow inventory section of it, which starts on page, where does it start? Page 131. They actually differentiate. You know, we think of longbows and we're like, okay, so there's just the U-bow and that's it. Maybe they oiled it, maybe not. So they have listed here as two different types of bows. They have painted bows and white bows. So obviously they were painting their bows at some point. The white bows probably refers to the unpainted, just natural wood instead, not literally white, but just the natural wood color of it. So it's just interesting, you know, you get that detail of, well, I didn't know they painted bows. Well, there it is right there. They paint, there's in 1344 and 1351, they had 7,525 painted bows. So that begs the question of, why did they paint them? Was it a longevity thing? Did the wood last longer? Did it keep the wood from drying out?
And that's assuming that they're painted in their entirety and they're not painted in some ways, like for instance, they could be banded to mark them as. Because we also don't have, when I'm looking through the same page you have, if I understand correctly, they don't have like weights specifically listed, but perhaps they used paint to identify poundage, or, and that could be done with fully like just making it completely red, or they could be putting bands on it. And painted could also not necessarily mean the same. It could mean, like you're saying, to protect it. Who's to say that they didn't use the same word for a varnish or a lacquer? And we've seen the word, anything you do with a brush, getting used with the same nomenclature, too. And we don't know about anything about color or anything like that. So again, limitations of the inventory. And that, I guess this is a good point to say, like, just because you see the word painted there doesn't necessarily mean showing up with, you know, with your hot pink shellacked bow makes any sense.
Oh, I have a goal now.
So you're going to have your hot pink bow and your falcon hat and your orange square hood, and you're going to be the most outstandingly eclectic medieval person.
Oh, that is a completely different conversation we need to have of looking, you know, because technically, except for the hot pink bow, probably, of course, but like having a painted bow or something, every single one of those things could be documentable as happening in history, but it doesn't mean they happened all at the same time. That's a different episode. Join us next time on a very special How to Medieval, where we talk about combining different things. But so you're going to, it's like still here. I love this. I love this on page 138. 649 sheaves of arrows of ash, 4,426 sheaves of normal arrows. What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? Again, they weren't making notations for our benefit whatsoever.
Exactly. It's like, so they knew, this is the common knowledge of time. Oh, normal arrows are made out of this type of wood. Everybody knows that.
They're the normal arrows. Who needs to define that? Yeah. Me, please.
Yeah, please. It's like, we want to know, well, in another one, it says, it's not calling them normal, but it says 599 sheaves of arrows of ash, 1,719 sheaves of ordinary arrows. So there's that, sometimes they're great for finding out, what was used, how much of generally was used, what could have been on hand, things like that. But they do have raised questions of, what do they mean by ordinary arrows? Because I look at an arrow made of ash, I'm like, that sounds perfectly reasonable and ordinary to me. Ash is a good, strong, straight-grained wood. What does ordinary mean in this context? And that's the problem with these. Is there is a lack of context 100% on what some of this means.
But they do also support other things that we have developed in other parts of our research. Like you said, because of your research, you fully understand. You see ash and go, oh, well, that does make sense. It feels like a reasonable arrow would, because of the other information you have. It was said, arrows of willow, you've been like, if you knew nothing about wood or arrows or bows, you'd been like, okay, well, that sounds fine. But knowing anything about wood and arrows, you go, well, that sounds like an odd choice. And then that would give you a question of like, why did they do it that way? But it's only because we have done external research, and just reaffirming a point we made before, it's only because we've done this external research that any of that either looks normal or odd.
And you'll find lots of odd things that go, that things, we've sort of been over a lot of them. They sort of just stick out of what the hell does that mean? Because there's just a lot of that, and a lot of it you just need to dig more and ask people, reach out to people about what this could possibly mean, especially for things for like talk about the painted bows. I don't believe from this time period there are any existing bows. There's the Mary Rose bows, but that's from almost 100 years later, so, or a little over 100 years in some cases. And I don't think any of them are painted at all. So, or is there any indication of them being painted? So having this written of painted bows, that's something that's piquing my interest. I got to do some digging on that one, because I like the sound of a painted bow. Sounds fancy.
Especially if it is like actually vibrantly painted, because then that adds to this idea of this goes against our constant railing against Hollywood's mythology of the drab and boring Middle Ages. Like, if literally the weapons themselves are colorful, because I know that when we do research into things like tents and banners, things that people almost never do is paint their tent posts, except we have plenty of indications that they literally like color coded and painted them specific colors, and maybe even barbershop style, like spiral painted some of their tent posts and things, especially in like the king's tents. And there was, again, if they painted everything else to be so vibrant and colorful, I mean, if it didn't affect the actual function of the bow, it doesn't seem unreasonable. It actually sounds, if you think about your typical medieval archer from the context of, say, Hollywood, where everyone was drab and poor and disgusting and dirty, it's like, wow, a painted bow sounds really weird. But then we do enough research that we see that they pretty much decorated and made everything powdered or, checked and multicolored and particolored and painted. Like, a pretty bow sounds pretty reasonable.
So looking through the paper more, it looks like the painted bows were used for hunting. So it very well could have been a way to delineate that they were a lower poundage bow and they were for fun hunting, you know, or other than the white bows they call them, which would have been the war bow.
Or it could have something to do with their attempts at color coding their uniform entirely for hunting. You know, we've talked about in the hunting episode how they wore specific colors certain times of the year, and was that camouflage has to have been at least some part of the idea, because as we talked in that episode, they would also wear trees on their heads, you know, typical ghillie suit style.
They could have been painted with like a verdigris to make them green so that they blended in more. That's not about it. If you are a medieval archery or hunting expert and know anything about painted bows for hunting, please send us an email.
Absolutely. That would be very interesting, because that's one thing I've never seen, or at least, well, if they painted it green enough, maybe that's why I haven't seen it, but I have never seen, but I don't think I've ever seen anybody actually paint a bow for loosing arrows from. But at the same time, I don't know of any research outside of, say, a paper like this that gives any indication on how. And then that goes back to our conversations about experimental archaeology, where you have to set these types of experiments up under the understanding that we don't necessarily know what we're doing. We just know that this was a thing that might have been done. And so now we're playing around with how would it work? How would it look? Like, if you put the wrong kind of paint on things, the paint cracks and bows flex, and they didn't have what is that paint not acrylic, it's the other one, latex. Yeah, they didn't have latex paint. So how did they manage to paint a bow in such a way that it didn't crack and chip when it was flexing for flight? And these are all interesting questions. A stain, is it like a dyed color? And how much support do we have? Like, I know that modern woodworking, you put like mahogany stains on things. Do we have any indication that wood dyeing was something that was practiced outside of wood painting? I know that there's a lot of resources for like the types of paints that work for things. I know you've done a lot with like gesso and milk paint and such, but is wood dyeing a thing? I just don't know the answer to that. But this is,
I know verdigris will painting with verdigris will more or less stain it than actually paint it. So
yeah,
that might be it'd be interesting to learn what's going on more into that. But yeah, the whole like the camouflage thing reminds me of that meme. It's a woman sitting in a diner at a table with a man, and the man's dressed in full like, you know, camouflage, and the caption says, "It's so sad to watch people eat alone."
I like it. I don't even think I've seen the meme. I just knew where it was going. That was fantastic.
There's my, like, oh man, I guess you guys are out in the woods. Didn't you bring your bow? Yeah, I got it right here.
So there was a, talking about things that blend in, there was a, there's a TikTok. I don't know, TikTok. But there was a TikTok, and it was, you know, Mom, I can't find the milk in the fridge. And it shows like an empty fridge. And then like Mom's hand reaches in to the empty fridge and like grasps something that isn't there, and then the video goes all like digital, and she pulls out a carton of milk from nowhere.
Getting back on topic here,
it doesn't exist.
Getting back on topic, I guess that's my fault. I did that one. I brought the news. What's great about this is it even gets into showing the use of firearms during the time. And I love how it differentiates. There's 23 cannons, and then there's two guns shooting bullets. So it's differentiating those guns at the time that basically shot whatever you want out of, or probably the cannons, and then the smaller firearms shooting the small round projectiles. It's really great to see. It's that's the thing about these. It's like some places they're not detailed at all, and in some places they're very detailed like that.
Well, I suppose it's not completely unreasonable for new technologies to have a sense of detail that other items don't, because sort of like what we were saying before, you know, who doesn't know the answer. Like, it's made out of normal wood. Like, who doesn't know what normal wood is? That's, you know, duh information. But this new fancy boom technology, you know, people need to be detailed about what is what, because most people may not know what the particulars are. So that nuance is required. And we see that with technology all the time, where, you know, we'll differentiate between small differences in new fields, but then after they become common usage in 20 years, we don't really spend a lot of time trying to parse out which particular version of a, like a software or a technology we use. So that actually, that tracks with, at least anecdotally tracks with what makes sense. And we see that. We see people say, oh, well, no one needs to know how this, no one needs to explain on this topic. But conversely, everyone needs to make sure that I got this newfangled doohickey in the right spot and not mixed up with a different newfangled doohickey.
And that's something that's actually some of the detail when you get into the, they call it the military textiles. So things like gambesons, acatons, things like that. I love at one point, it says there were two jupons with the old royal arms. Not just saying the royal arms, they have the old royal arms.
And if those kinds of things, if those kind of things change, that is an important detail that, you know, we don't want to wear necessarily the wrong, you know, maybe that's, those have been relegated to being worn under something else instead of on top of something else because they're not worth throwing away yet, but maybe it's too expensive to repaint, or they're appliqued or embroidered or detailed in a way that isn't easily updated, you know? So, all interesting food for thought. And I guess the theme here is that inventories are more confirmation of other concepts or food for thought for new research, which makes them a very swingy source to use.
And it's also, like I said before, it ties in this whole idea of the change of the military system. We know England during the time period that this is reflecting was an archer heavily dependent army. Mm-hmm. And yet we have evidence from the armaments and arms that the archers probably had more armor than what everybody thinks they had, because it was available to them within these garrisons and these inventories like this. And it just shows that change in the mindset of, okay, come to war and bring your, like I said earlier, come to war and make sure you're prepared for it, to, okay, come here, let's get all your stuff together and get ready and go. While it probably a lot of people were still bringing their own stuff, because who wants to use loner armor? Anybody who's ever done any fighting in the SCA knows you don't want to use the loner armor.
I don't know. We went to real war with loner armor on in modern military, so it's not necessarily that terrible. It's not like I bought my own IOTV.
Want to see?
I don't even know if they'd let me go with that. Like, if you showed up in like your Aegis carrier, and I could just see the face on some supply NCO as he's trying to figure out just which way he's gonna smoke you for all your nonsense.
but that goes back to the, you know, that 17th century when you get into Cromwell, where he wanted basically the state army of everybody's using the same equipment, everybody's training the same way with the same equipment. And that's the birth of what the modern military was. The only way to make sure that they had what he wanted is the state had to supply them with the armament and arms for it. When this time, I mean, while there's still these garrisons where they were supplying things, it's funny because, you know, you never knew what you were going to get. It's the qualities. These are just the listings of the things. We don't know what the quality of a lot of this stuff is. You know, it's like part of it says they had, one of the inventories had 11 acatons in it. It's like, it could have, 10 of them could have been full of moth holes and one of them could have been absolutely perfect. But there's not,
that's true.
They're not differentiating between those two. There's like 11 of them.
And we're also applying two separate cultural perspectives to it. So in the beginning of the garrisoning of equipment, you have a culture of people who are used to bringing their own stuff. And they'll be like, oh, who would want to use somebody else's, you know, stuff? And then, you know, we turn around and my joke about my modern experiences in the military, we've encultured something completely different, wherein who would trust their own aftermarket stuff when the military provides you what you know is reliable and fits with the rest of your unit. So it's interesting, the cultural differences there, which I'm not necessarily applying evenly or correctly to make a legitimate historical interpretation.
Looking at the textile portion of this paper, and I'm not sure if he goes into this or not in there, you got to be a little careful. We all know that these terms were pretty fluid. That they used a lot of terms that could have been, you know, it could have been for separate things or could have been for the same thing. It's that whole jupon argument. What is a jupon? You know, is it the long sleeve, slightly padded garment that they wore over armor? Is it the no sleeve, heraldic martial cert coat type thing, which was sometimes called a jupon? Was it something completely different? And it's like, it's interesting here. It's like in this list on page 181, he lists 11 akatons and then 5 akatoners. I don't know if there's any real difference between those.
But it was different enough to be worth writing down.
Well, the thing is, so I don't, this is just a breakdown of it. That says, this was from the, I don't know if that was from a single source or if that's just a list.
I don't know. I haven't read that particular section deep enough to answer the question.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't know if it was all from the same list, basically, or if this was a list composed of a number of different of a few different inventories, because it's for an almost like an 8-year time span. I don't know how often they went through and did these inventories, every year or not, but or if two people, like one person was on one side of the room starting on one side, another person on the other room starting on the other side, and they came together and they put their list together. It's like, well, one guy was calling these things akatons and one guy was calling them akatoners. All I can think of was isotoner gloves.
Right.
Maybe they're the gloves. Like they're padded gloves. But
And that could, it could be come down entirely to spelling, and they didn't bother to audit their inventories. They just slapped them all together because one guy's like, all right, I got a ticket from you. And then they hand it to Mr. Scribe and they say, make a whole list. These two guys did stuff. You know, it could be as simple as that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there could be that, like you said, that lack of auditing, and there's like, okay, we have a list now. That's great. So that would be all of these things open. All these questions open up further research. There's a lack of consistency in terminology. That's the real issue of it. And we sort of have to take it as.
Now, because another wild card here, if we're looking at 181, there's that list that says akatons and akatoners. You go down to this grid on the next page, they are more specific about akatons versus akatoners of plate. So perhaps this is some.
Well, that's further up. There's a different list. The receipt of textile armor in Robert Mindenhall's account, which started on page 180, mm-hmm. says 46 doublets, one large and covered with white silk, 14 akatons, 2 covered in velvet, 1 in russet silk, 2 in silk, 1 in red leather and green silk, 8 in white fustian, 2 jupons of the old royal arms, 5 akatoners of plate covered in cloth.
Right.
So
could akatoners be something, you know, if Akaton is meant to just reference some sort of jacket of protection, could Akatoner be shorthand for a jacket with some sort of plate on the inside? Is this like some early version of coat of plate? Is it, I mean, is it, you know, I know that we in later periods see like jack of plates where it's plate being sewn in between two layers of cloth. So while we tend to see most coat of plates and things like that being using leather, how much of it was textile and how much of it was quilted textile? Because we know that they combine male and quilted or gamboised fabric together for increased effectiveness. Did they ever play around with doing that with quilted fabric? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud of what could these differences mean based on the interpretations that we've seen in these various lists.
And what's the difference? It says two jupons with the old royal arms. Then below it says 32 tunics of arms, one of red velvet, one of silk, one of cloth, each of the old royal arms, and 29 with estouchions bearing the arms of Saint Lionel. Those are the estouchions are the small shields. Sometimes we see them on like aventails and things like that in artwork. So, Andrew, this is, you know, this, like I said, a lot of these, while you get a good idea of what they've been using, it opens up so much more research for you. And I actually had an idea. I'm having a Zoom session with Tobias Capwell probably sometime around that this airs. I'm going to ask him if there's if he knows the difference between what an Akaton and an Akatoner is.
That'd be fantastic. I'd love to hear his answer to that question. So we'll link, if it comes out before this comes out, we'll link it somehow. Show notes. But I think we've given people a lot of food for thought here.
And well, definitely like, highlights.
What's a chipolette? Look at that grid.
The rabbit hole goes for hundreds of pages.
Look at that grid that you were talking about on page 182. Uh-huh. It's like shirts, coat armors, Akatons, Akatons with plates, chipolettes. I'm like, what's a chipolette?
Well, I mean, here we get to play with that pal talk, which is one of those contentious words too. So
don't even.
There's only 20 of them in 1360, so you're safe.
Don't get me going on pal talk. Oh my gosh.
So yeah, so if you hate pal talks as much as Matt, give us 5 stars. I really think that we have so much that we could talk about with this information, which is why it was important to do this topic, is because we're talking about these inventories here. And this is just, you know, we say just 100 years of English inventories. You know, we still have all of France, all of Germany, all of Italy, where we have this type of information available to us. And these are all just sort of the questions and confirmations we can develop from using this particular resource. So I think this was definitely a great survey of what people can expect using this as part of their greater research.
I propose a research challenge for people.
Okay.
Using this document, and it's available for download, it's free.
We'll link it.
You will link it. I propose someone, anybody, I'll do it too, because I think it's interesting. So I'll do it and I'll post it. But what you do is, using the inventory, piece together a reasonable kit inventory for an interpretation for some time during this time period, with actual sort of, you could use pictures if you wanted to, or just little short descriptions of what it is you're using. I'm going to do this too. I think it'd be an interesting, fun thing too. And we'll post it to the Facebook page.
Yeah. And everyone can make new posts there for their interpretations. That way, if we have them post to, in response to our post, then the conversation gets muddled. But if everyone goes and they make their own post to the Facebook page in the community tab, then we can have discussions on each person's interpretation.
And if you already have a kit put together using something like this, and you just want to take a picture of yourself and then write down what you did to put it together, how you connected it to this.
Ooh, self-audit. How well does it comport with the inventories? And how have we discovered any reenactorisms in our own resources?
Yeah, but also, R and I have been talking about maybe starting a How to Medieval Instagram profile. So if we can get pictures of people doing this, maybe we could actually put them up on Instagram.
Oh, I like that. There we go. This is a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm glad we did this today.
Do your homework, folks.
Yeah. You have your assignment. Chop, chop.
All right.
Well, Matt, I'm really glad we talked about this today. It was a little more technical. Well, I'm glad we're, you know, for everyone that has stuck around all the way to the end, you know, you will be better for it. That's what every teacher has always told you about the harder subjects. But this is definitely one of those ways to really, this is what, you know, separates the, you know, what they say, the mice and the men, you know, those interpretations that really get it on a fundamental level tend to use the more granular resources like this, and they help it to create not as like a one gun, this is my silver bullet for proving my impression, but as a great way to really round out an impression and give it more depth and give it a little more authority.
Yeah, no, I can't even say anything to that. That's right. It gives it more depth, gives it more authority. That's the perfect way to say that, Ari.
Excellent. Well, thank you everybody for listening. I appreciate you being here. If you have any responses that don't fit that Facebook response for your homework assignment, you can always send us an email at howtomedieval@gmail.com. That's T-W-O. And if you leave a soundbite, we'll play it on the show. You have something to say, a question to ask, things like that. We'll bring them onto the show. You can participate without having to wake up in the early in the morning.
Thanks, folks.
Bye.
Bye.